Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP professional, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. And you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. And podcasts of prior shows are also available there. And under Public Affairs, Your Financial Choices. Today is February 12th, 2020. The markets were up today with the Dow closing at 29,551, the NASDAQ at 97.25, and the S&P at 33.79. Our topic tonight is deciphering tax documents and why you might want to know how to decipher them. We are live tonight. We will take your questions. Lori C. is in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic, and I will do my best to answer them. The number is 610-758-8810. And if you're not comfortable talking live on air, of course, you can give your question to Lori, and she'll write it down and bring it in. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. So again, phone number for live on air or off air, give your question to Lori. See, the number is 610-758-8810. So why did I think it was important to talk about deciphering tax documents? Well, as regular listeners know, you know, it's tax season, and I usually try to talk about tax-related topics during this time of year because this is typically what is utmost in everyone's mind, what's going on with, you know, their tax preparation and documents that they get. And sometimes you get something you've never had before and you wonder what it is. So I thought it might be important to talk about looking at some of these tax documents, but even as important is sometimes you have these tax documents and maybe you're not, you know, looking at all of the numbers on the tax document, and there could be some important information there for you. So I thought, why don't we go over it? Starting with the W-2, and in particular, the W-2 has several boxes, and I didn't print it in to bring into the show, and I probably should have printed it. But the W-2 has your federal wages box, your Medicare box, your Medicare wages box, your Social Security wages box, your federal withholding, your Social Security withholding, Medicare withholding, state wages, local wages, state withholding, local withholding. And those are the things we probably pay most attention to when we're entering our information in our tax return. But there's a whole slew of other information that is also important in box 12. And box 12 has a lot of codes in it. So unless you know what the codes are, you might not understand what all these numbers are that are getting reported. We take it for granted that our wages are getting reported properly from our employer, and maybe that's all that we pay attention to. So I thought we could go through some of the codes that are on the W-2. I'm going to start first, though, with Mary from Macungie, who's off air, and she had a question regarding the standard deduction. What are things over and above the standard deduction that can be used? Mary, that's a good question. So the standard deduction is something that the IRS came up with that just kind of applies to tax filers. Typically, it's based on your filing status, single, married, filing joint, or head of household. And those standard deductions can vary. And it can also get a little bump if you're over age 65 or if you're blind. So there's some extra little bumps you can get to the standard deduction. So for married filing joint or a qualifying widow, the standard deduction is $24,400. And if you are age 65 or older, I think it's another $1,300 for 65 or older. And this is for 2019. Single filers and have a standard deduction of $12,200. So this is something they just kind of give us, you know, to take off of our income. But if you have certain expenses that, when added together, would exceed the standard deduction, you can use Schedule A for itemizing your deductions. So that standard deduction is to encompass some expenses that they expect everyone kind of has, you know, certain kind of real estate taxes and housing, and maybe everybody gives some amount to charity. So they come up with this number, and I don't frankly know how they come up with this standard deduction number. But what the Schedule A itemized deductions includes are medical expenses, taxes, charitable contributions, and mortgage interest. Those are the big ones. In the past, there was a section called miscellaneous itemized deductions, and that's gone right now under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which sunsets in 2026. So, Mary, to your question, what are the expenses that are over the standard deduction that you might be able to take? It's a little tricky because you heard me mention medical, but the medical, before you can even start to count it, has to exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. So basically your page one income times 7.5% is the medical limitation. So you could only deduct over that if, when added to the other items on Schedule A, it comes over the standard deduction. So already a lot of people don't get the medical deduction because they're, you know, 7.5% times their income. Sometimes their out-of-pocket medical isn't that much because you can't take a deduction for medical that you have through work because that's already getting a tax-favored treatment, so you can't double dip. So medical's a hard one to get. And it used to be 10% for 2019, but under the SECURE Act, they changed it to 7.5% again. That's what it used to be. They changed it back. The next category, taxes, that used to be a really big deduction for people, especially people who worked in high income tax states with state and local taxes. Now they cap it at $10,000. So between your state and local withholdings and your real estate taxes, if those are more than $10,000, you only get to take $10,000. So that's the cap on that, $10,000. If your real estate taxes and your state and local withholding are under $10,000, then you're limited to that amount. Okay, so let's pretend you're at $10,000 with your real estate taxes and your state and local taxes. And let's assume you don't get any medical. Well, if you're married filing joint and the standard deduction is $24,400 and you're at $10,000 with taxes, what's going to make up the $14,400? You might have mortgage interest, and you might have charitable contributions. Typical charitable contributions might be $2,000, $3,000. Some people, $10,000. Some people, a lot more. All depends. But if your mortgage interest and your charitable contributions are more than $14,400, in my example, and you have the $10,000 in taxes, you might be right even, break even with the standard deduction. And in that case, you're going to take the standard deduction. So it's only when those expenses, taxes up to $10,000, mortgage interest, charitable contributions, and possibly a little bit of a chance of getting some of the medical, when you add those together, if they exceed the standard deduction, then that's what you get to take. It was a long answer, Mary, but I love the question, and I think it's good that people understand it. This is why on prior shows I've talked about there may be opportunities for people, especially those who are charitably inclined, to bunch their charitable giving into 1 year to see if it could help get them over that threshold and take advantage of being over that threshold, and then in subsequent years just use the standard deduction. So there is a little planning that people can use to try to be able to itemize, but it's a little bit harder with those high standard deductions. And what they did with the higher standard deduction is they took away exemptions. So personal exemptions are gone. But for those people who had children, they increased the child tax credit. So some people won and some people did not win. Mary, thanks for the question. I love that you called in. Folks, if you have questions, you can talk live on air with us or off air, whatever you're more comfortable. Lori C's in the studio to answer your calls at 610-758-8810. Back in a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or wdiy.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on 88.1 WDIY. If you have questions this evening, the phone number is 610-758-8810, and email is also available through yourfinancialchoices.com. We are talking about deciphering tax documents tonight, so I thought I would start with the W-2, and the main boxes that most people look at are the wages and how those get reported. I thought it would be important to look at the codes that are in box 12 as well, because those might mean something to you. So, for example, recently my brother told me he didn't have any life insurance. I was doing some planning for him. I looked at his W-2, and I saw in box 12 code C, and code C in box 12 tells us that there is some taxable cost of group term life insurance over $50,000. So right there, it told me something that my brother technically kind of hadn't realized. Now, I later talked to him. He said, yeah, I forgot about that. But here's the issue, especially like when we talked last week about planning your financial life and getting your financial life organized. These are the kinds of things that would be very important in your financial planning to understand and know, and not to necessarily breeze over or forget that you have it. So code C in box 12 tells us that someone has life insurance that, if you were to pass away, is worth, the death benefit would be more than $50,000. If it's $50,000 or less, there's no code C because the employer is paying for the cost of that. If the coverage for the death benefit for that employee is higher than $50,000, the IRS tells the employer they have to impute income to that employee for this benefit. And what that means is they're not handing the cash to the employee to buy the life insurance. The employer is paying for it. But because it's worth them more than $50,000, that's considered a taxable benefit to the employee. So the employer has to come up with a value for that extra cost for the health insurance above $50,000. And they report it on your W-2 under code C. So if you look at your W-2 and you see code C, you know that you have group term insurance through the employer with a death benefit of more than $50,000. Back to last week, planning your financial, getting your financial life organized. If you have group term insurance through work, you want to make sure that you have your beneficiary designations for primary and contingent on there. Typically, you review that at open enrollment period. The other reason code C is important to people in Pennsylvania residents, it's not taxable for Pennsylvania, and your employer should adjust for that. And in a little while, I'm going to talk about, if I have time, talk about Pennsylvania has a W-2 reconciliation page that if for some reason your PA wages don't match to your Medicare wages, they want you to explain why your Pennsylvania wages and your Medicare wages don't agree. Now, sometimes that just goes through with no problem, but occasionally you'll find an item that Pennsylvania would have no idea what it is looking at your W-2 unless you do a little interpretation. So these codes help us sometimes interpret what would be taxable for Medicare, but maybe not PA, or vice versa, not taxable for Medicare, but taxable for Pennsylvania. So code C is one of those adjustments, but typically the employers catch this. Where I sometimes see they miss it is when you have an out-of-state employer. Sometimes their payroll systems don't know that it's not taxable for Pennsylvania, but it is included in Medicare wages. Another important box in a code in box 12 on the W-2 is code D. D as in dog. That tells us how much someone is putting into a 401k, and it includes a simple 401k as well. So if someone's making $100,000 and they have $10,000 in their box 12 code D, that tells me $10,000, that would tell me they make $100,000. They're putting 10% of their pay into a 401k, and that's on a tax deferred basis. They don't pay tax on it for federal, but in Pennsylvania, we do pay tax on it. So your Pennsylvania wages are going to be higher than your federal wages in this case. So code D tells me they're putting away money on a pre-tax basis. pre-tax basis. So you're getting the deduction on federal today. We don't get a deduction for Pennsylvania. When we retire, all that retirement money will come out taxable for federal, and it will not be taxed in Pennsylvania because Pennsylvania doesn't tax retirement accounts. Code E, very similar to Code D, except it tells us it's a 403B plan versus a 401K plan. 403B plans typically we see with nonprofits, hospitals, universities, schools, that type of thing. So D and E, basically tax-deferred pre-tax contributions to retirement plans. I'm not going to go through all the codes because there's lots of codes, but I'm trying to hit the important codes that are very interesting to look at. Code G is elective deferrals and employer contributions to a Section 457B deferred compensation plan. You might not see this as often, but for maybe higher compensated employees, they may want to defer paying tax on some of their wages if they're in a very high tax bracket today. And the IRS allows us to defer the taxes on those amounts that we say we're not going to take right now. They go into a special account, a 457B account, and we're not going to pay tax on that today. And there's all kinds of qualifications on the employer's part for these types of plans to have them qualify for this benefit. So deferred comp might be something that we would see in Code G. And that lets you know, maybe you had forgotten or didn't even realize what you were signing up for. Maybe you are at work and you're, getting paid more money and someone mentioned you should check this box and you're going to do it. You might not even realize that you signed up for this deferred comp plan. So you would see it on your W-2 under Code G. Some other boxes that we would see less often, but I see it on some, retirees. They get a W-2 with no wages, but they have something in box 12, code M and N. It's uncollected Social Security on some of this group term life insurance that's imputed income over $50,000. Typically, we might see that on a retiree. The Lucent retirees had those W-2s for years showing that imputed income for that life insurance that they were still getting as retirees. Quite often that goes away at a certain age, maybe at age 70, that benefit goes away and we kind of see that drop off. Okay, let's see. Code V, income from exercise of non-statutory stock options. This is something which is non-qualified stock options. We're not always seeing this as often anymore. Some people still do have stock options. That's where the employer grants you an option to buy stock at a certain price in the future. So there's an exercise price. You buy it in the future. When the fair market value is much higher, that's when it could be a good deal for you. You're buying it at a lower price. Non-statutory stock options. I don't really see this as much as we used to. I think employers have kind of gotten away from it, and you see more employers, if they are rewarding their employees, they're doing it with restricted stock units or restricted stock awards and things like that, where they're just kind of saying, here's some stock we're going to give you for your great service and, contributions, and we're going to give it to you in 3 years. And then in 3 years, they give you the stock and they include it in your W-2. So stock options versus RSUs. This is code V for non-statutory stock options. And it's the income from that exercise that is included in the wages. So a few more boxes to talk about on the W-2, and then I'm going to, when we come back from our break, and then I'm going to talk about the 1099-R, which is very important to those people who are retirees, possibly getting a 1099-R. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with us or off air. Give your question to Lori C. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY offers many choices and real voices.
This is Rosalie.
And Steve.
Join us and other hosts each Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. for Swing Sunday, a great mix of swing, big band, and classic vocals.
WDIY is the Lehigh Valley's local source for NPR news, public affairs, and diverse music at 88.1 FM and streaming on WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices, and tonight we're talking about deciphering tax documents. And I'm starting with the W-2, and I need to make a little clarification. Earlier, I said code G, elective deferrals under employer contributions, to a 457B deferred comp plan. There are a couple different kinds of deferred comp plans, and 457B we sometimes see with also government workers, and certain kinds of deferred comp might be eligible to roll over into a retirement account, and certain kinds of deferred comp plans are not eligible to roll over into a retirement account and actually are taxable when a certain event occurs, which could be retirement or X number of years, where you get the payment of that deferred comp over after you retire, and that would be taxable. And we have code Y, deferrals under a section 409A non-qualified deferred comp plan. So I wanted to differentiate between that. Some other codes that are interesting to look at when I'm, you know, looking at W-2s for people, AA, code AA in box 12, that designates a Roth contribution under a 401k, so it's called a designated Roth. So if your employer has this feature in the 401k, usually they'll announce that at open enrollment or, you know, you'll when you're first signing up. Code AA tells us that you're making Roth contributions through your 401k. Those are not pre-tax. Those are done on an after-tax basis, but that money, so it's going to be taxable in your W-2 for federal and state, and it's going to be taxable, but then when you take it out, it is tax-free. The contributions through a designated Roth are tax-free, and the earnings on the designated Roth are tax-free. But why I think it's important to look at that and remind yourself and kind of understand is occasionally someone will sign up for the Roth feature under their 401k when maybe they first start a job. It hasn't been around that long, but they might sign up. And over time, they get raises, they get promotions, and all of a sudden, they're making a lot more money, and maybe they're in a higher tax bracket. That's when that code AA should stick out to you to say, hey, wait, I'm doing Roth, and maybe now it's time that I switch to the code D, the tax-deferred, pre-tax regular 401k. So it's kind of a highlight for you to pay attention to. Just like the code AA, code BB is a designated Roth under a 403B. I actually have never seen someone come in with a code BB, so I don't know how many employers with 403B plans have actually adopted the Roth feature for their retirement plan. But code AA, I definitely see. I especially like to see it when we have young people who are just starting out and they're in a low tax bracket. I like people putting that money in those Roths. With the recent SECURE Act, non-spouse beneficiaries who inherit from people who die 1/1/2020 into the future have accelerated required minimum distributions. They have to take it out over 10 years. So frankly, we're going to start looking more and more at this if it makes sense to, from a family standpoint and a family estate planning standpoint, does it make sense maybe to do more Roth, even if you're in the 22% bracket or the 24% bracket, because your beneficiaries, when they inherit this money, if they have to take it all out so fast over 10 years, it could put them in a very high tax bracket. So from a family standpoint, sometimes people come in and say, I want my kids to have money. I want to pass on to them. Well, if we want to do that and be smart about it, we need to kind of address how we're maybe putting money into our retirement accounts. Scott from Bethlehem called in off air. He says next year he's retiring at 65. He has an annuity that that will begin distributions. Will they be taxable? Are distributions sent out monthly? Does he keep on paying into the annuity? Scott, if I'm trying to understand if your annuity is through work, sometimes people will, if they're working for like a university or a hospital, they might have something with TIAA, used to be TIAA CREF. So sometimes they have like an annuity, a traditional annuity through that. And if it is through a retirement account, basically, when you take distributions out of the retirement account, whatever form it is, they're going to be income taxable when you take it out if it's in a retirement account. So in your mind, it might be an annuity. They might have restrictions if it is something like the TIA on how much you can take out of that. Sometimes they say 10%. So that's one thing. If money is in a retirement account, it gets taxed as it comes out. If it's in a retirement account, meaning an IRA or a 401k, maybe you roll it over when you retire into a rollover IRA. When the money comes out of those, however it is invested, it's all coming out as ordinary income. If, however, you invested in this annuity, it's called a non-qualified annuity. You invested in it, and let's pretend you put in $100,000, and when they sold it to you, they said, hey, this is going to be great, because when you retire, you're going to get $1,000 a month, whatever it might be. I'm making up these numbers. If you annuitize it and elect to annuitize it, then the taxable portion, it's going to be prorated. Because if you put in $100,000 and it's now worth $180,000 and you take out $1,000 of a month and you've annuitized it, it will be prorated. If, however, you've just invested $100,000 and it grows to $180,000, again, this is in a non-IRA account, so your $100,000 grows to $180,000 and you decide, you know, you didn't annuitize it officially with the company, you're just going to take out, you know, $10,000 a year. The earnings come out first. So yes, the earnings come out first out of a non-qualified annuity. Some really, really old ones, it was a different format, but most of the annuities we see today, the earnings come out first. And it would be income taxable for federal purposes as ordinary income. So whatever ordinary income tax rate you're at. And I was going to mention this too, Scott, so I'm glad you called, that if you have a non-qualified annuity, as we've just described, that's in a non-retirement account, and you take out some of the earnings, it's taxable for federal, it's also going to be taxable for Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania taxes these annuity distributions as interest. So some people don't catch that on the 1099-R. You want to look for code D. I think it's code 7. D will indicate that it's a non-qualified annuity, and Pennsylvania will look for that code, and it would be taxable as interest for Pennsylvania purposes. So that is a good question. Now you ask, do you keep paying into the annuity? Well, if it's not a retirement account, so when if you're working and you're doing it as part of a 401k or a 403b, you know, you're making employer-employee contributions, you could be getting a match, that kind of thing. Once you retire, you can't keep putting into it. So once you've severed employment, you can't keep putting money into your employer plan. And as far as a non-qualified annuity, usually people just do like a dump in and don't continue to put into it. So I hope with the information that was given, that was enough to answer your question. And thank you for calling in with that. And we are going to talk about some of the codes on the 1099-R as well as we go through the show here. To wrap up the codes on the W-2, I don't know if there's really any that are otherwise important. I could say that you take your W-2, and when I mentioned the W-2 reconciliation for Pennsylvania, you may or may not even have that on your radar, but where it would be important to have on your radar is if Pennsylvania sends you a letter saying they can't reconcile your W-2 or that you owe more money, it could be something to do with that reconciliation. So that could be very important for you to look at, the W-2 reconciliation for PA, where you reconcile your federal wages to PA, your Medicare wages to PA, and your PA wages to Medicare. So they make you do it in three different columns in a couple different ways. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Talk to you soon.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
You're listening to Your Financial Choices here on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. Currently 45 degrees. Tonight, rain mainly after 7 p.m. That means we have only a half hour until we start getting rain. New precipitation amounts about half to three quarters of an inch possible, down to 33 degrees. Tomorrow, Thursday, a 70% chance of rain before noon, then a slight chance of showers between noon and 1 p.m. Cloudy, 51 degrees. Thursday night, a slight chance of snow showers, 26. Friday, we get sunshine, 31. Friday night, 13. And Saturday, sunny again, 32. Saturday night, 24 degrees. We continue with your financial choices now and your host, Lori Siebert. Lori.
Thank you, John. Folks, we are talking about deciphering tax documents tonight and why it might be important for us to spend a little time looking at those tax documents that come in the mail. And keep in mind, if it is a tax document, it will always have on the outside of the envelope, stamped at this time of the year, important information enclosed. Important information enclosed. That's a required stamp on the outside of envelopes having anything to do with tax information. I'll tell clients, if you get those envelopes, just throw them in a file, throw them in a file, throw them in a file. So that's what we're talking about. We've done W-2s. We're going to talk about 1099-Rs, which are, in my mind, I like to think retirement. That's how I, you know, help people know what the 1099-R is. There's a bunch of different kinds of 1099s. So the 1099-R, it helps, can keep it in your head that this is typically retirement money. If you have questions, you can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, you can give your question to Lori C. and she will bring it into the studio. The phone number is 610-758-8810. 610-758-8810. And by the way, too, for folks who are listening, next week, the show is going to be listeners' tax questions. So if you haven't started your tax return, you could start going through everything. And then if you have questions next week, you could call in. It's my favorite. Well, it is my favorite time of year. Some people think I'm crazy, but it is. And I love listeners' questions. So 610-758-8810. So looking at the 1099-R, box 7 is the one that I'm typically looking at to see, what is this? What is this payor trying to tell me that this payee received? And there's a number of codes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then there's a bunch of letters, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, and you, J, K, L, you know, no L, J, K, L, yeah, there is an L, M, N, P, Q, R, S, T, U, W. So what you'll see typically is a number with the code. Sometimes it could just be a code, but a letter, I mean. So typically you might see the number with a letter and sometimes just a letter. So the 1099-R, code 1 means early distribution, known exception. What is that telling me? That is telling me that someone took money out of a retirement account before age 59 and a half, and the custodian did not know that if that there was an exception. And this could be for a distribution from a retirement account, or it could be even a pension. I think I've seen code 1 before, which, you know, might not seem right. So early distribution, no known exception. Just because it's coded 1 doesn't mean it's right. So someone might have coded it 1 because they did not know that there was an exception. So for example, someone might have taken money out of an IRA, let's say $50,000. They get a 1099-R showing $50,000 taxable distribution, code 1, and that would tell the tax preparer or your tax software that that's going to be subject to not only tax, but also a 10% penalty. But maybe what the person who distributed the money didn't know is that you put it back into your IRA within 60 days. The IRS allows us to do that. It's called a 60-day rollover. The first custodian might not have known that. There could be other exceptions as well, and you would just have to indicate that in the software to the IRS that there was an exception that applied. So that's why it's important to know about that code, because if you had an exception and you didn't know about this code 1, you just put it in the software and you weren't paying attention, you figured it's doing its right, it's It's going to tax it and put a 10% penalty on it. So you want to look at these. Code 2, early distribution exception applies. Under age 59 and a half, early distribution, but an exception applies. Typically, I see that for people who maybe were early retired from work and get a pension. So if you get a pension and you're 55, but you had enough years of service in, the employer is going to code that too. Early distribution exception applies. The reason why it's important to know that is sometimes the software could get funky and try to maybe tax it in Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania might tax some of these retirement monies if we take them out early. So you want to make sure you have the codes right, you understand what they are, and if it applies. So if an exception applies, Pennsylvania is not going to tax it. Code 3, disability. That has its own implications. Code 4, death. Why that would be important to make sure you're entering the code properly is if you have inherited, for example, an IRA from a decedent, and you took the distribution that you were required to, because you're required to take out a minimum distribution from an IRA when you've inherited, and they code it for death, that lets me know if you're, 34 and you have an IRA distribution, we're not used to seeing that because you're too young. It would be like, oh my gosh, you have to be 59 and a half. Well, that's not true if you've inherited an IRA. You do not have to be 59 and a half, but you do have a required minimum distribution. So that code for death tells me that there is an exception to the 10% penalty for that as well. Still income taxable in an IRA distribution scenario, but not subject to the 10% penalty. Another reason it could be important is if we're preparing a tax return and someone had a big annuity last year, 1099-R for $50,000, and this year they don't have that 1099. It's like, wait, what's the difference? Last year they had this $50,000 from company ABC. Why don't they have the $50,000 this year? Well, if I go look at the 1099, I'll say it was death. There's another box on that 1099-R that says total distribution, and that would tell me, oh, that was all distributed in, last year, so I'm not going to be looking for that same kind of income this year. Very important. Box 6, Section 1035 exchange. This is if someone moves some annuity monies to another annuity. It could be a tax-free exchange. It's code 6. That tells me nothing's taxable because it went from one insurer to another insurance provider. Okay, so it's just a tax-free exchange. The IRS allows that to still happen for life insurance, annuities, qualified long-term care insurance, and endowment contracts. Code 7, the one we probably see the most, is normal distributions. But again, you can sometimes see these letter codes that go with it. So earlier, our caller asked about annuity distributions and, how are they taxable and that type of thing. You might see a 7, normal distribution, and code D, annuity payments from a non-qualified annuity that may be subject to tax under some other provision, okay? So annuity payments, that tells me, code 7D tells me that's an annuity contract. That's important to me for federal purposes, but it's more important for me for our Pennsylvania residents, because that taxable portion is going to be taxable for Pennsylvania. Now, as I mentioned earlier, it's the earnings that come out first, but once you hit your original investment in that contract, so in my story, I had a $100,000 annuity, and it was worth $180,000, and let's say they take out $10,000 a year over 8 years, and it hasn't grown anymore. Once I get down to my $100,000 original investment, if I take that out, I could take out the whole $100,000 then with no tax consequence, because your original investment comes out tax-free in that scenario. If you've annuitized it, then it's pro rata, and that's a little bit of a different story. So that's code D, important to watch for Pennsylvania purposes. Another code we see is code G. It's a direct rollover of a distribution to a qualified plan or a 403B plan, 457 or an IRA. So if you do a direct rollover, code G tells me it's not taxable. It's letting us know we rolled it over from one retirement account over to another retirement account. You don't always get a 1099 for these. Sometimes I have seen where if it's a trustee to trustee transfer, we don't always see the 1099, but I haven't in my mind figured out when they do it and when they don't, but for the most part, it is a tax-free transfer. If I see a code J, that tells me there was an early distribution from a Roth IRA, and that could have some implications that you might want to attend to. Because you're not supposed to take early distributions from a Roth IRA, but that would only happen if you were taking out, basically, earnings. So if you take out original contributions, don't expect a problem. But if you take out earnings and it's before age 59 and a half, the longer of 5 years or age 59 and a half, then you could get hit with an early distribution penalty. All right. I want to also talk about 1099 consolidated statements, but hone in on 1099 div. That's div for dividend. And the reason I want to point this out, really, it's more for people who probably are self-preparing their returns or maybe having a friend prepare the returns, just to make sure that you're aware of some of the boxes and what they mean. For the most part, if you have software, when you enter this information, for the most part, it's probably going to go to the right places. So that's one thing to know. So why else would I want to point this out? Because I look at a tax return as a financial planning opportunity every time I look at one. It's not just about reporting your income and paying your income tax. It's about what do I do with this valuable information that I get. Marry this to last week's show where we talk about getting your financial life organized and in order. When we look at a 1099 and I see dividends, I'm instantly looking for how much of these dividends that someone's making on their investments are qualified dividends. That means they qualify for a lower tax rate. If someone tells me, oh yeah, I've got my investments, it's all great, and they show me a dividend statement, and it says $3,000 of ordinary dividends and zero qualified dividends, well, there's no exposure to the market there. That's basically fixed income that are wrapped into a mutual fund. So the mutual fund's paying out a dividend, but it's not really equities that are paying out the dividend. So when I see $3,000 in my example, $3,000 of ordinary dividends and $3,000 of qualified dividends, that tells me of the $3,000 ordinary, $3,000 qualifies for a lower tax rate. That is powerful information when we look at what assets someone has and how they're investing, and are they paying attention to how one piece of your financial life affects another piece of your financial life. All right, so box 1A and box 1B. So 1A shows the total dividends that you have from your investments, and 1B tells you how much of those dividends qualify for the lower tax rate. Very powerful information. That is 1099 INT, interest. 1099 INT, that's interest income on our investments, and that's ordinary income. And ordinary income for interest is taxed the same as those ordinary dividends that aren't qualified. It's all ordinary income. And if you're in a high tax bracket, it's going to get taxed at a high rate. When we come, we're at our last break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the dividends. And I want to touch, hopefully before the end of the show, a little bit on Social Security. I don't think I'll be able to talk about K-1s, but those are really complicated anyway. Well, they could be. So we're going to finish talking about our consolidated 1099 when we come back from the break. If you have questions, there's still time. The phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, give your question to Lori C. She'll write it down and bring it in to me. We'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Tune up your week with a great variety of jazz music on WDIY. Monday through Friday nights from 9 to 11 offers Many choices from the world of jazz, featuring traditional to modern styles, plus Swing Sunday at 5 p.m. and improvisational jazz on the bridge Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Listen for new releases, interviews with artists, and information on upcoming performances right here on WDIY.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on 88.1. Podcasts of prior shows are also available at wdiy.org under Public Affairs. Your Financial Choices and lots of different shows there. Tonight, talking about deciphering tax documents. We've talked about W-2 codes. We've talked about 1099-R codes. And now we're looking at the consolidated 1099. So it's not so much codes here as boxes that you have to pay attention to. And there's more than I'm going to talk about, but meaning more boxes. I'm not going to talk about all the boxes because it's complicated. But my favorite, qualified dividend box. Next favorite, capital gain distributions. So box 2A is capital gain distribution. So that's typically people who have mutual fund investments. So they've invested in a mutual fund. The mutual fund is a money manager, buys all of these different, you know, stocks and bonds or whatever they do, whatever makes up their fund. And then throughout the year, they might be buying and selling. And at the end of the year, they kind of reconcile their books and they say, hey, folks, during the year, we had these kinds of gains and we're going to push some of those gains out to you. So here's your capital gain from all the transactions we've done during the year. Here's your share. So that's a capital gain distribution. That's reported in box 2A. And for federal purposes, that is also subject to the lower tax rate. So I really like those long-term capital gain distributions that we see on our 1099 in box 2A. If you don't have any other sale transactions, the IRS allows you to just put those right on the front page of your tax return. But if you have other sales of positions, investments, and things to report, you would report those on Schedule D, and then that box 2A number goes over there on Schedule D. So here's something to pay attention to, again, between federal and our Pennsylvania state filing. If on the federal return you have a capital loss, current capital loss from investments you've sold during the year, you've harvested loss, you might have a loss there, or you have a capital loss carryover from prior years, and you have this capital gain distribution, they can offset each other. So those losses can offset that capital gain distribution that you got from the mutual funds. That's great, and that makes sense. It's logical. But Pennsylvania doesn't like that. They treat those capital gain distributions like dividends. And if you have a loss on Schedule D for Pennsylvania, they don't let you use that loss against any other category of income. So Pennsylvania doesn't allow us to use one class of income's losses against another class of income's income. So that's why you might sometimes see a difference between your federal filing and your PA filing, and maybe you don't even pay attention to these things, but I think it's fun to pay attention to them so you kind of know what to expect and you can understand your numbers. The reason it might make a difference for you is if you're someone who has to pay estimated tax payments and you have maybe a fund that pays out huge capital gain distributions, because some of them do, you'd want to make sure that you have paid in estimated income tax payments for the tax that would be incurred on that income. All right, so that's one of the reasons you kind of want to know that. There's a box 3. It says a return of capital. A lot of people might not know what that is. It just means that they're not really paying you a dividend. They're paying you back part of your investment. So it, in essence, lowers your cost basis moving forward. Box 4 shows backup withholding. What I'm interested in that box, why I'm interested in that is, first of all, a lot of people miss seeing that box if there is backup withholding, because you don't expect to see federal withholding on a consolidated 1099 div or, you know, interest statement. So backup withholding means that provider, that custodian, doesn't have a W-9 form on hand for you. A W-9 tells that payor that, yes, this is truly you. Here's your address and your social security number. And you're letting them know you are a person and they will not withhold. If you don't give them that W-9 form saying your Social Security number, even though on the statement your Social Security might be there, if you haven't completed the W-9 in your original application, they might do backup withholding. So you can easily fix that. It's a huge flag when I see that happen. Box 5 is something we're going to see more of, I think, with this, the most recent tax act where they give us something called a qualified business income deduction. We're seeing more funds have investments in maybe rental real estate, something that would, or business income that qualifies for a qualified business income deduction. It's called a 190 section under section 199A. So that might be a new box you're not familiar with seeing. The issue that we're running into is, let's say there's $10 in that box. What that means is that $10 is eligible for this qualified business income deduction. Well, it's 20%. That would be $2 on 10. But if you take a qualified business income deduction, it lowers the penalty threshold from the IRS for under reporting. So you want to be careful whether it's worth it to take that deduction, because a $2 deduction is not going to have any impact on your tax return. But if you are a business owner and your income, could get scrutinized, or you might have misreported something, you might not want to be exposed to those higher thresholds on penalties. Box 11, exempt interest dividends from a mutual fund. So we can have tax-exempt interest for interest income. Some people will get by a municipal bond. A municipal bond is a government bond, and it's not subject to tax for federal purposes or for the particular state where the municipal bond is. But you still have to report that tax-exempt interest. And years ago, I would see people did not report tax-exempt interest. And it is important to report it, and custodians are getting much better. They are reporting it now. Years ago, it would be like an informational statement. But it's important, because the treatment of tax-exempt interest or tax-exempt dividends is different for federal than it is for Pennsylvania, for your state, whatever state you're living in. So for federal, it could be tax-exempt if it's a municipal. But for the state, it's only going to be tax-exempt if it's for your state or certain other territories of the United States. So if some of the mutual fund is invested in PA municipal bonds or Puerto Rico or Guam, those would be tax exempt for Pennsylvania. But if you're a resident of Pennsylvania and you've invested in Virginia bonds, those are not tax exempt for Pennsylvania. Those are taxable for Pennsylvania. So when we're reconciling the tax exempt interest or the interest from Fed to PA, that is some of the differences there. There might also be some state income tax withholdings on some of these documents. You really got to watch for that. Also on 1099-Rs, sometimes people will have state withholdings on the 1099-Rs. Pennsylvania does not like that. They don't like to see it. And sometimes they'll say you owe money even when you had withholdings, and they make you prove it over and over and over again. I want to kind of close out with the last few minutes we have just talking a little bit about some of the other items we might see, like Social Security. The reason I wanted to mention this is because a lot of people don't really have this on their radar. I'm not exactly sure why. When people sign up for Social Security, you go down to the office or you do it online. Did you know you can have withholdings on your Social Security? I don't think the office offers that up or mentions it, really. Or maybe some, service people do and others don't. I rarely see withholdings on Social Security, but sometimes people will have a lot of investment income when they retire and then have Social Security. And if they have a lot of investment income, they might owe taxes, but they don't have maybe wages anymore. They don't have maybe IRA distributions yet. So they don't have withholdings to cover their federal estimated tax payments or their federal tax. So instead, they're having to do quarterly estimated payments. And a lot of people don't like doing the quarterly estimated payments. Well, the IRS deems withholdings to be done evenly throughout the year. So if you miss a quarterly payment, you could get really slammed on that. Whereas if you do it through withholdings, it's deemed to be done evenly throughout the year, and you're less likely to have you know, underpayment penalties. And I even have people who do all of their tax payment through their IRA at the end of the year. Like, we'll say, okay, we're not going to do quarterlies, but at the end of the year, we're going to take all of the anticipated tax due out of the IRA. Since if you have to have a required minimum distribution anyway, let's put some piece of it or all of it to the federal withholdings, and that covers it. But you can take withholdings out of Social Security. It's very similar to when you file for unemployment. It's a W-4V, V as in Victor, and you fill out your name, your address, your Social Security number, and on line 6 of this W-4V, you let the government know how much income tax you want withheld from your Social Security benefit. And there's only 4 options, which is kind of nice because then it's predictable. Like on a pension, you know, they're looking at tables and figuring out what your withholdings are, and they don't always withhold enough. But with Social Security, you know what your Social Security benefit is, and you tell them what the withholdings are. You know what they're going to be. So there's the 4 options are 7%, 10%, 12%, and 22%. And you can change this as your situation changes. So on occasion, we've had one spouse maybe collecting Social Security and the other one is still working, so they're in a really high tax bracket. Well, we can have withholding at 22% on the Social Security spouse. But then when both are retired and we don't have those high wages coming in anymore, the taxes are going to go down, and you don't maybe need to withhold such a high amount of 22%. You could drop it to 12%. So that's really something nice to know. And I don't know off the top of my head is if you can do that online at ssa.gov. I do know you can just Google for the form W-4V, print it out, and fill it in. And I think that you cannot mail the form to Social Security. I think you have to walk it in. So that's why the options might be to walk it into the Social Security office or to, you know what? Now that I'm saying that, it might be that they don't let you walk it into the office. I think you actually have to mail it in. You might have to mail it in. So they don't give you instructions on this on the website as far as how to deliver this, whether you mail it or deliver it. So I would go with mailing it to your local office. So that's form W-4V, and those are your options, 7%, 10%, 12%, 22% on Social Security. The K-1, again, I'm not going to talk about too much, but we might start seeing more of these as well as people invest in different types of opportunities and partnerships, and maybe you're a shareholder in a S-Corp or a partner in a partnership, a beneficiary of an estate or a trust, you're going to get a form, a Schedule K-1. If you are a beneficiary of an estate or a trust, you need to make sure that you wait for that K-1 before you file your tax return. And on that document, they're going to tell you all the different categories of income that you have to report. And they tell you by putting it in different boxes, and you just report it in the software that you have or give it to your accountant to report. And it's fairly straightforward for the most part. If you get into some more complicated master limited partnerships, they get very complicated, and there's pages and pages of information to read. Make sure that you give that to your tax advisor, because the literature in those additional pages could be very important as to the filing requirements, and we don't want anybody to get in trouble by not filing all the proper documentation. Folks, thanks for calling in tonight. I appreciate it. I want to thank Lori for being here tonight and John for sitting in for Shandi. I really appreciate it. And listeners for calling in with your tax questions. And next week, I hope I get a lot of listeners' tax questions, because that is what the show is about next week. Listeners' tax questions. So think what you might have. Work on those tax returns. Let's hear what the problems are that are arising. And hopefully we can help you move forward and get those tax returns filed and done. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices, and have a great week.